Blog Talk Radio.
Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. Tonight, we're discussing creative visualization, which is one of the essential techniques of magic. And we'll start with the theory of Platonic preform images, and that is in contrast to and working together with the Kabbalah's magic of the word and the number. And we'll move on to explain the highly developed Tibetan tantric imagery and its effects. We'll give examples of successful creative visualization, ours and others. We will discuss how people visualize and how they can train themselves to control this process. The use of magical color will be explained, and we will mention works by Franz Barden, William G. Gray, OPL, and others. And we'll discuss our particular methods and their applications. So, as we said, tune in and get the picture. Now, I want to remind you that the call-in number, if you want to call in and discuss tonight's topic, or any topic that we've discussed that you're in, that you want to ask a question about, our call-in number is area code 347-857-1830. Now, we have a lot to cover tonight, so please call in, but keep your question brief and on topic, and we'll try to answer it. Let's get into this very fascinating subject, and I think this one's a lot of fun, and one that we can all benefit, whether you're a magician or not. This is a technique that just has all kinds of wonderful effects and results attached to it. This really is a form of magic all in itself, and it's one that is pretty easy to do, and really very, very effective. Now, I want to start off with a theory of why it works, philosophical theory of why this works, and why we can visualize things and actually bring them about. We can bring material things, and we can bring people to us. We can bring material things to us. We can influence the development of events. We can do wonderful things with this. But that is the reason for that is the theory behind it, of course. And we should go back really to Plato. Now, Plato, as it's been recently revealed, was actually a closet Pythagorean. We found out that's been pretty well established. So he was in the same Hermetic line, pre-Hermetic line, as Empedocles and Pythagoras and that whole bunch. Now, anyway, Plato is pretty well known for his idea of preforms on what we now call the astral plane, the formative plane of higher dimension, formative plane. And what Plato came up with was the idea, or he used the analogy, of the ideal chair. And this is this before there can be a chair on the physical plane, before the chair gets sketched out and carved out and you know, has the legs glued on or whatever, there has to be somebody has to imagine the chair. And this is the ideal chair. It is the chair that's imagined, the chair that becomes a sort of the archetypal chair. And then it's on the astral. And then if this chair is visualized and imagined in enough detail to where it can be constructed, then that preform influences the creation of the chair. The chair, the idea here is that if once the chair is imagined, and it's imagined in enough detail, and it's imagined in enough intensity, that chair is going to come about. Somebody's going to build the chair. And this theory, this ideal form theory, is what is behind the whole process of creative visualization. So my esteemed colleague Lon Duquette, in his Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford, which I heartily recommend, he takes the Platonic chair idea and he brings it all the way down from the top of the tree of life, way up there, and you know, he has God way up in Kether. God says, you know, in Asaluth, God says rest. And then the angel, the archangels in Bria, they one level down, they say, God wants a chair. And then all the draftsmen and the workers down in Yetzirah, down in the astral, they say, hey, the boss says he wants a chair. Put it on the drawing board. So they all go to work designing this chair. And then down in Malkuth, down in Ashiya, where we are, the chairs are in the showroom. You know, or they're in the factory and they're coming out and they're on the showroom. So this is the, using Plato's ideal chair, this is what Lon came up with. Now, this also works with sex magic too, because the whole idea of sex magic, I think, as we've discussed before, is you create a magical child, a magical offspring that precedes, you know, or takes the place of the actual offspring, and the sex act is used to establish that, and that's very powerful. And then again, you should use creative visualization along, you know, with that to implement that technique also. Now, we just say to compare this and relate this to that other kind of that other conduit of magic. The magic of the word, the magic of the mantra, the magic of the Kabbalistic formula, that spoken word. Now, that is very effective also, and it really, really hits the subconscious mind, and it is very effective. And of course, ideally, the magician combines visualization and the magic of the word. He combines the two together, ideally. Now, we're in a little bit of going back and looking at history a little bit. Let's compare pagan magic of the Egyptians and the Babylonians and compare that to the to the Jewish magic and Islamic magic. Both the old Jewish rabbis and the Islamic imams, they tried to suppress imagery. They tried to suppress the use of imagery because they felt that this would empower people to go and do magic on their own and whatever. And so they came up with this idea of no graven image, you know, and all this. And even went so far as to you shouldn't do pictures of people. You shouldn't imagine pictures of gods. You shouldn't Yep. Everything should be the Word. Now, this sort of thing, still, the magic was effective, the magic of the Word, obviously, because, as we know, the Kabbalah and the Greek Kabbalah, of course, came first, but, I mean, the Hebrew Kabbalah and the Greek Kabbalah, you have your letter is also a number. So you have mathematical formulas that also relate to letters, and this does affect the deep mind. Now, one of the books we're going to recommend with a qualification on creative visualization is the one by Ophiel, The Art and Practice of Getting Material Things Through Creative Visualization. This is a really good little book, and I recommend it with one qualification. He does not think that the Word, he says in there that the Word does not affect the subconscious mind. I don't know why with all of the, that was a mistake on his part because he knew better. But for some reason or other, he said that. Don't be tripped up by that at all. The Word, the sound, and by the way, in the Islamic version of the Kabbalah, which is popularly called Abjad, but that's not what they really call it. But they are more concerned with the phonetic part, the syllable part of the word, than they are with the numeric, the alphanumeric combination. But regardless of that, the word is in both Arabic and in Hebrew is tremendously powerful, and those formulas. In modern Hermetic magic, anyway, they're combined. Now, Hermetic magic, we use visualization very, very strongly, and in the Kabbalah, they're a little bit reticent on it. Still, in the Hebrew Kabbalah, they're a little bit reticent. So, they're losing part of their power there. Although, once you plug visualization into the Kabbalah, it does increase the power and the effect. Now, the idea of visualization, as I said, is you visualize a picture of something that you want to bring into the physical realm, something that you want to have an effect in the physical realm, something that you want to use to influence the physical realm. And this visualization can be combined with the word in mantras. It can be combined with the word by taking the letters. This is why we like Phoenician, by the way, in lieu of Hebrew, because it's so much easier to visualize Phoenician letters. They're very monolithic. They're very runic. And you can imagine these Phoenician letters in color. And in the colors of the various spheres and everything. And, well, you know, Barden wrote a book called The Key to the True Kabbalah, which even though his Kabbalah is all kind of in a German alphabet, he derives it, I think, from the Sefer Raziel. And you can translate Barden's ideas on how to visualize these letters and how to pronounce these letters. Barden says the pronunciation of the holy name is actually visualizing it in all four Kabbalistic dimensions at the same time. This depends upon, as a Hermetic Kabbalist would certainly agree, this depends upon creative visualization. Now, let's talk about how this works in the Far East, in Tibetan work. The Tibetan tantrics, and I have had some experience with that, and so I need to point out with them that visualization with them is all important. This is, and what they do, and we have learned a lot from them, I'll tell you. What they do is they meticulously create these various god forms and goddess forms. And, of course, they're Buddhists. Well, most of them are. They're Buddhists, and so, therefore, these goddess and god and goddess forms which, by the way, come from the original shamanic Bunpo, and then they got some of them they brought up from Hinduism and whatever. And a few of them came down from Mongolia and whatever. But essentially, they're Buddhists, and so as far as they're concerned, all this is essentially illusion that you're creating. And their attitude is philosophically that the whole universe is illusion, including you yourself and whatever. But therefore, their theory is that whatever you create in your imagination is just as real or can be made just as real as anything in the physical world. Because if it's all illusion, then what you're seeing in the physical world, even the chair you're sitting in, is a measure of illusion. It's a measure of illusion, so consequently you can create another chair hanging in the air and it's just as real as the one you're sitting in, according to them. So, as an exercise to prove to you that you can control the whole universe, that is illusion, of course, then what they do is they sit for hours and hours and they build up in their minds very elaborate, plastic, totally realistic, 4, 5, 6, 8 armed deities, some of them pretty ferocious, and they bring these to life, and then they bring them, they make them so real that they come to life. And of course, if they are inclined, they could send them out to do things too, and you know, and bring things and whatever. But then, supposedly, if you're a good Buddhist, you're supposed to take this god form, and after you've brought it to life, then you're supposed to dissolve it. And then, you know, and then go into a sort of a Zen type of meditation and say, I created it and I dissolved it. Well, you know, the difference is with us here in the West, in the Hermetic proposition, is we believe that everything in the universe, including what you imagine, has a measure of reality. That's very important. The one big difference between us and the tantric Buddhists, the one big difference between the hermetic magicians and the tantric Buddhists, we believe that everything in the whole universe is a measure of reality. They believe that everything in the universe is some measure of illusion. Now, you may think that this is sort of similar to the same thing, but actually there is a difference, and yet we can use their methods. We can use their methods. It's just that we really we don't need to dissolve the entities at the end. We can just put the entities in our pantheon and use them, and create your own god forms. Bring your own god forms to life, which is what we do, of course, in our psychic center system. And the Tibetans have taught us a great deal about how to do this. And they've taught us how to do it and how to effectively do it, the techniques for doing it. And they are primarily forms of yoga. And so from that, now I'm referring not just to my own work, but Franz Barden. Franz Barden is a form of Raja and tantric yoga, in a sense. Crowley, he didn't quite get to this. He was very, very much into yoga and getting his students to do various forms of yoga. But he never was that I know of that he managed to completely integrate. The hermetic system and his yoga system. And I think he would have gotten around to it if he lived longer. He probably would have. And, of course, in Crowley's time, we didn't know as much about how they actually did things and all that as we do now. So we'll forgive him for that. But he did definitely start us off on the path of putting the yoga in with the magic. Now, I want to talk about creative visualization at the most basic, even non-magical level for a minute, and kind of tell you some anecdotes about how it works and things you can do with it, just to give you an idea that how effective it can be. One of the things that people who even magicians do this, we'll get an image, a photograph, a drawing, or whatever, or we create one. If you're an artist, you can create one, and make a picture and of it, and that becomes your treasure map, so to speak. And you put that, where you can see it every day, and you look at it, and you say, I'm going to get that, or I'm going to meet a woman like that, or I'm going to meet a guy like that, or something like that. And you keep looking at that, and you keep thinking that. This way you don't have to, you don't really have to imagine it yourself. You create the thing, and then you can think about it, too. You should be able to imagine it in your own mind and on your front screen visualization. But you don't even need to do that. You can create this picture or put together a collage or whatever you want to do, like a treasure map. Now, as an example of this, from my own experience, back some years back when I was working for a corporation over in Glendale, I was the art director, and I was very much into sailing at the time, and still would like to get back on the water, but I was really interested, really wanted a nostalgic old-fashioned schooner. And I couldn't quite afford what I really wanted. And what I really was yearning for was a 50, 60-foot ocean-going, gaff-rigged, old-style gaff-rigged schooner, Pacific, South Pacific trading schooner, kind of an Errol Flynn kind of boat. And this is what I really wanted. And I was dreaming big. So I got a picture of a drawing, actually, a side view drawing of the boat, rigged exactly the way I wanted and I liked it. And I took this drawing, and then I realized that I was going to need to color it in. Now, that's an important point. You got to have whatever your treasure map is, your treasure picture is, it's got to be in color. It has to be, and I'll give you some examples of why it has to be. Anyway, so I colored the hull blue, and I colored the superstructure cream color, and I fixed the boat all, and put it in color, and then I put it up on my desk, above my desk. And my boss came by, and he looked at that, and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "That's my boat." And he said, "Oh," he said, "That's your boat, huh?" He said, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to get that book." And so he just kind of and walked away. And, take that 50, 60-foot schooner. That's quite something to be wishing for. Well, so often he'd come by and he'd look at that and he'd say, "Well, you got your boat yet?" And I said, no, not yet, but I will. And then about 3 weeks after that, my friend Dave Finnan called me up and said, "Polk, there's something in the boat trader you ought to look at." And told me the what page. So I went out that afternoon after work, and I on the way home, and I picked up a copy of the boat trader, and I looked on the page where David indicated. And here was this gaff-rigged schooner, 19 feet long on a trailer, and a guy was selling it. And it was a day sailor, but wow. And you'd imagine this, two-masted gaff-rigged schooner on a trailer, 19 feet long. And I got Dave, and we went out to Lake Ferris, way out in the U.S., and sure enough, there was this British fella, and he loved to build boats, and he built this thing, and his wife didn't like it. It was a little too radical. So he wanted to sell it. He sold it for next to nothing, and it was a brand new boat. And it was painted exactly the same color scheme as I had put on my boat. It had the same rig exactly, but it was 19 feet long. It was on a trailer, and I could afford it. I could easily afford it, so I bought it. And we took it home, and put it in the front yard in Pasadena. And then, of course, a couple of days later, my boss came by and he said, "Well, you got your boat?" "Yes, as a matter of fact, I have." He said, "Oh, come on." And I said, "Yeah," I said, "I got it." And I said, "You know," and I said, "You want to come over and take a look at it?" So he drove over after work and he took a look at it and his jaw dropped down and he said, "My God," he said, "you did it." And I said, "That's right." But not only did I do it, but it was in the length and in the size and in the configuration that I could afford. Not something I couldn't have really, you know, if somebody had made me a good offer on a 50, 60 footer, at that point I would have been in the poorhouse trying to just keep it up. But this was perfect. And we sailed that boat. We called it the Valkyrie. We sailed that boat for 6 years. Dave and Ed and I, we put it out in every ramp all the way in Southern California. And so this shows you, and by the way, that made such a believer out of my boss that he became, from a total materialist, he went and took a version of Silva Mind Control, and then he became a firm believer in creative visualization. Now, however, I wanted to make sure, if you do this sort of thing, be sure that you do these pictures in color. Because there was a story, I think Jose Silva tells it, a story about the gal who wanted to take a vacation in Hawaii, so she had a picture of Diamond Head on her desk, and she kept looking at that, dreaming of a vacation in Hawaii. And finally, sure enough, she won. She actually won a vacation in Hawaii. But, unfortunately, it was a two-week vacation, and the whole time she was in Hawaii, it rained steadily. Now, the picture was in black and white. Picture of Diamond Head in black and white. That's why it rained steadily, because the picture was not in color. Now, of course, another example, which is kind of sinister, is the Nazis knew about this, and they made a fake photograph. We used to call them cosmographs in those days, before Photoshop. We did them with airbrushes. They made a fake photograph of the boulevard in Prague. And down the main boulevard, they had these stormtroopers marching. And they had to piece those in, of course, and then airbrush them in. So they had this whole column of stormtroopers holding the swastika in there, marching down the main drag in Prague. They made a photo mural out of this, and they put it up in the war room while they were planning their invasion of Prague. Well, you know, they were very successful in the invasion of Prague, but then one of their top Nazis, Heydrich, was assassinated, and of course they lost the war and all that. So it should have been, if it had been in color. Well, if it had been in color, maybe. I'm glad it wasn't. Anyway, but this sort of thing actually does work. Now, however, let's talk about visualization that you do, not just pictures that you put together, although that is effective. The visualization that you train yourself to do. Now, it's important that you understand that visualization, creative visualization, to be done correctly, has to be done in a certain area. It you can't have it floating around. Well, you can, but it doesn't work that well to have it floating around in the back of your head. Now, unfortunately, some artists, some people, like myself, originally, that's where I had it. I get nice visualizations, but they'd be floating around out back in the middle of my head somewhere. I didn't do them on front screen. I didn't do them in front of my closed eyelids. I did them back in my head, and being an artist, I'd sort of bring them to life on the paper, but they were being created back in the head somewhere. Well, now, that doesn't work all that well for creative visualization. And, by the way, I discussed this with Fred Adams, and he said, and he's a wonderful artist, and he said the same thing. He had tremendous imagination, but he was visualizing back in his head somewhere. Now, For effective creative visualization, you need to get it on front screen. And what I mean by that is, Jose Silva says, close your eyes and imagine a widescreen movie, a screen about 6 feet away from your closed eyes. And it fills your whole closed eye vision. You know, you feel, that's where you imagine your, and that's about ideal. That's really ideal. Imagine that about 6 feet in front of you, and it's a big screen, like a big television set, high-definition TV set, and you got your eyes closed. Now, that's the perfect framework. Get it around, and you need to get it out of the back of your head and get it around, get it on that front screen. Make sure it gets on there. Now, Jose Silva also points out another couple things that are they're very important. If you want to do kind of moving pictures about what you want to have happen, then bring it in from the left. Bring it the picture in from the left and off to the right. Now, the reason for this is that the left, moving from left to right, that's the way the brain works. That's the future is on the left and the past is on the right. So be sure that if you're making a sequential, that you do this left-to-right visualization. Now, along the line of magic itself, in pure magic, you know, in the magical process, you know, creative visualization, you don't have to be a magician to use it. A lot of people, they're not magicians. And by the way, Silver Mind Control is a wonderful program. I strongly recommend it. A lot of creative visualization, you don't have to be a magician. This will work for anybody that seriously does it, for getting things. Remember, though, in magic or in anything else, you're going to get, if you do this right, you're going to get what you want, but it may not be what you need. And it may not even be what you really want either. But in my case, you know, as I overdid it, I was looking for a boat that I couldn't afford, and sure enough, I got the same kind of thing in a form that I could afford, and that was thoroughly enjoyable and worked out perfectly, and so in this case, it worked for me. But as Sophie L. points out, you should be aware of certain limitations. Don't wish for something that's going to drive you to the poorhouse or sail you to the poorhouse or something like that. Worse for something that's within the realm of what you can handle. And the same thing applies to people, by the way. You can take a Playboy Playmate, I suppose, if you're a guy, and use that and keep looking at that all the time and saying, I'm gonna get a girl like that. I'm gonna get a girl. Well, yeah, you may, but then on the other hand, maybe you may end up being more miserable than you want to be, and yeah, it might very well work. I did a comic strip, you know, one time, and I was doing it with one of the guys at work, my fellow artist, and we were going to get this comic strip, kind of an R-rated thing, I called it Valkyra. The heroine was a 7 foot tall Valkyrie with spiked steel breastplates and a little wolfskin bikini bottom and, you know, and whatever, with a winged helmet, kind of a R-rated Wonder Woman kind of thing. You know, in doing all the work I put in on that, and it was a lot of fun, I ended up with one big blonde after another. it was a sort of a, you know, you put enough visualization into that, and sure enough, they walk in your front door. So you can use this to attract people. You can do all sorts of stuff with it. Now, however, to get into the purely magical end of this, what we like to do in magic is we like to be able to train ourselves to where we can visualize very clearly and ultimately with eyes open, very clearly and specifically, and hold these visualizations visualizations of angels, talismanic images, all these various things. We like to be able to throw them out there on front screen and hold them and make them as real as possible. And the more real we can make them, the more effective they are. And it's like the Tibetans, you know, their idea is keep making it realer and more and more real and more and more real and more and more real and more and more real. And when it reaches out and bites you, then you reabsorb it and then you start over again with something else. Now, that's what they do. But what we want to do is we want to make our guardian angels, you know, on the four quarters. We want to make them real. We want to make our God forms real. We want to make these images as plastic, as real, and as effective as possible to get these things across. So what we do is we actually, when we're doing this, we're actually bringing them into life on the astral. Yeah, because remember the preform theory. You bring it out there, you imagine it, and some essence of it's going to be out there. It's going to be, you know, you're bringing them to life. And especially if they're traditional forms, you're really enlivening them. Because remember, in Hermetic philosophy, you're the center of the universe. And when you step into that circle, in the center of that circle, you're God. Now, what I'd like to do, and get a little formal here, I'd like to read you one of our lessons, and I'll go through this as carefully as possible. I'd like to read you one of our lessons in this particular practice so that we can get the magical perspective across. Now, this is called Magical Visualization Training, and it pretty much covers how this is done from a magical point of view. Now, the mirror and crystal scrying methods that we have taught you thus far have made the wonders of magic accessible to you without natural clairvoyance or years of rigorous training. However, these intermediate methods of invocation and evocation, effective as they are not the outer limit of the magical art. You have crossed the threshold, tasted the forbidden fruit, and seen glimpses of worlds beyond. Now, the life's work of the true wizard begins. You are going to train your mind to see and hear the angels, the spirits, and the wonders of the higher spheres without depending on the auric phenomenon of the crystal or your reflection in the dark mirror. You are going to transform your mind into a powerful magical device that can receive visions from the greater universe and project your disciplined will onto the matrix of thought forms that generate creation itself. The mind, as those who developed the Macintosh computer were aware, thinks in pictures, colored pictures, actually. Therefore, if we want to imprint our subconscious and the morphogenic field we call the astral, we can do it most effectively with images. Ancient pagan priests, who were often magicians, were well aware of this, and their so-called idol worship was an effective form of psycho-mystic mental and emotional programming. The power-hungry, monotheistic, biblical, and Quranic cults were also aware of this visual power and were intent on suppressing it. The magic of the word has power, but its ultimate secret power lies in the visualization of the formulas in all the scales of emanation. And we refer you, in this case, to Franz Barton's Key to the True Kabbalah. Tibetan Tantric Yoga recognizes these principles and has had a 1,000-year head start on us in perfecting them. We can learn much from our Eastern colleagues in this area, but we should remember that their philosophical perspective is not the same as ours, and therefore their methods are somewhat different. To oversimplify the difference, let us say that we believe everything in the universe has some measure of reality, whereas they hold that everything, including the universe itself, is an illusion. Now, this may seem to be the same elephant felt by different blind men, but it does bring about some practical differences in training. We insist on a whole universe that hangs together in one grand design because it is real. They can have a different system of symbolic correspondences for each entity because nothing needs to match up in a non-existent universe. We start with simple building blocks, whereas they start off with elaborate god forms, like Lord Chenrezi, who, and we had a joke about that, forewarned is forearmed. And at this point, the perceptive student will be asking, but what is the advantage of making pictures in your imagination? What do they actually do for you besides help you figure out how to draw or build something? Yeah, that's exactly right. To design and build something. That's what magical visualization is all about. This revelation brings us to the crux of Western magical field theory. Plato conceived the idea, the original idea, in fact, a pre-existing template for everything that manifests into physical reality. Plotinus gave this abstract concept a moving, generating force. Use the force, Luke. With this theory of emanations, one does not have to be a rocket scientist to see how these ideas provide the practical power behind Kabbalistic magical formulas. And those formulas, according to Frost Barton, need to be visualized for their full effect in magic, as in desktop publishing, what you see is what you get. So, let's do some deep breathing, pranayama, relax, yoga nidra. Calm our minds, and especially don't think of a hippopotamus, and let's get it on. Preparatory exercises. Now, before we start actually visualizing, we have to learn to control our minds and our bodies so that we can maximize the effect. We want to be able to hold these visualizations in a magical trance state, work with them. This means that we need to master basic yoga and self-hypnosis. For these prerequisites, I suggest two classic works, Fundamentals of Yoga by Ramutri Mishra, that's Raja Yoga System, and Self-Hypnotism, Its Technique and Use in Daily Living by Leslie M. LaCron. Both have been in print in numerous editions for 30 years. In yoga training, you need to concentrate on pranayama, breathing, and the process of Tratakam Yoga, the yoga of the fixed gaze. The latter prepares you to achieve the magician's steady, unblinking stare, so necessary for future visualization work. In self-hypnosis training, you need to concentrate on establishing the out loud dialogue between your conscious voice and your inner subconscious ear, so that, at this point, you should review the mental training exercises that we set forth earlier, making certain that you've mastered them before undertaking these advanced visualization exercises. That means self-hypnosis and basic yoga. You should be able to sit in an asana for 5 minutes with a completely calm mind before beginning actual visualization training. In our advanced master ritual, we require 32 repetitions of the mantra, "Through me flows a river of unlimited love," followed by 22 repetitions of pranayama cycle before visualization begins. Franz Martin starts us off in visualization with an exercise popularly known as Kim's Game from Kipling's novel Kim. It is a visual memory and concentration aid, which is good as far as it goes, especially for detectives, intelligence operatives, and military observers for whom it was developed. But William G. Gray, in his book Magical Ritual Methods, had a concept much more applicable to the magician. Gray starts us off with four basic objects, a knife, a paintbrush, a cup, and a disc. Black on the disc, black on one side, white on the other. Now, besides being a simple version of the Grail Hallows and the Magician's Elemental Tools, these objects also are creative agents and manifesting surfaces in their own right. Barden wants us to work on visually remembering a collection of nonspecific common objects as to position, size, and color, etc. This is good memory training, but misses an important point of the creative process. Our brain's optic sensor processor is programmed to filter out what it considers unnecessary sensory input. Thus, we only perceive as much of an object as we need to in order to identify it and to use it. But to design it and to create it, either as an engineer on his drawing board or a magician in his meditation, you need to do more than just snap a mental picture of it. You need to know the object in every aspect. For example, we're all familiar with pencils. We use them every day. But how many of us know how many sides a pencil has? Do we know how many bands and crimps there are in the eraser shield? Do we know what's printed and embossed, actually, along the side of the pencil? And at this point, we must admit, we really don't know pencils. So how can we expect to create one? The above conception is so important to this process that it cannot be overemphasized. This is why it is important to read Walter Atkinson, and he wrote under the name of Rama Charaka, his little book on Raja Yoga. His is one of the very few works to deal with this vital aspect of the imaginary creative process. So, to begin, we select the most simple and utilitarian objects to represent our four magical implements: a small paring knife, paint the handle yellow if you want to, a small watercolor brush, paint the handle red if you wish, or get a red handle, a shot glass, or any small glass tumbler, and your disc, 5 inches in diameter, white on the obverse and black on the reverse. Along with these items, you will need a small practice stand, about 18 inches high, a black cloth, 3 feet square minimum, a kitchen timer, and a small tape measure, a blackout mask, blindfold, and if you are in a noisy environment, a pair of shooting muffs in addition. And it's nice to have a horsehair cushion of the yoga meditation type to sit on. Now, 15 minutes a day, preferably in the morning, should be allocated for this training. Now we have our preliminary homework done. We have our basic texts, and we have our equipment. Let's get down to work. I've found that early morning, before the stresses of the day set in, and while the store of psychic energy is highest, is the best time. After coffee, but before breakfast. Remember to start with a few stretching and limbering up exercises, and take the asana, do a few minutes pranayama, put your black cloth over your practice stand, lay out your first object, the knife, the air element, the sword, the air dagger, Raphael in the East. First, study the object and the knife carefully. Measure it with your tape. Measure the handle, the blade, the width, the thickness, etc. Study the logo if it has one. Learn everything about this object and write it down in your journal and make a sketch of it with the dimensions and color it in. You will know more about this little knife than anyone except the person who originally designed it. Now then, put the knife on the table, close your eyes, and pick it up. This is important. Hold it between your hands with your fingertips and see it between your fingers. Now, you folks who think you can visualize on front screen behind your closed eyelids will see that you can. If you think you can, you'll see you can. This process brings you on front screen automatically. Remember that. You hold your object first with your blindfold on, and it'll bring it. keep your eyes closed first. Now slowly move the knife around at different sides and angles. Place it back on the table. See it lying there. Now open your eyes. Set your timer for 5 minutes. Close your eyes again. Pick up your object again and hold it until the picture is strong, and then replace it on the table and see it there. Hold this visualization for 5 minutes. Every time it starts to fade or go wonky, pick it up, pick the knife up again with eyes closed. Reinforce the picture with tactile reference. You have successfully completed this exercise when you can go a full 5 minutes on the stationary object using this method. It's much easier to accomplish than Barden's struggle until you see it approach. Magic is not easy. So take advantage of every technique that will help you along the way. Remember, Barden was a clairvoyant, and even though he knew his yoga and everything else, he really didn't know how to teach you this, how to teach you to visualize, because he was clairvoyant. Now, with eyes open, now that we have the eyes closed, front screen, behind the closed eyelids, and this is important, now we have the eyes closed, front screen, behind closed eyelids, and part of this is mastered to the extent that we can hold each of our practice objects clearly in view for several minutes. This is with eyes closed. Let's start moving them around, rotating them, and changing their size. That's without holding them. Remember, the small objects at close range are seen in isometric proportions, perspective. That is not a problem until we get perspective itself is not a problem until we begin to create environments. In Magical Ritual Methods, this is a book by Bill Gray, he provided one of the cleverest ways to visualize letters in Hebrew. And we prefer, of course, the Phoenician. When you have reached the stage where you can fully and steadily visualize your tools, you fill your cup, your little glass, with brightly colored paint, in the color allocated for the letter, and of course you're visualizing this, and you see the magic, the letter that you see in the magical alphabet. You dip your paintbrush, your little wand paintbrush, the fire wand, into your little chalice, and you're doing all this with your eyes closed now, and then describe the letter on your disc, and you're seeing all this either in the back side, the black side, or the white side, and be sure to vocalize and vibrate the letter or formula as you visualize it. This combines the dynamic movement of your astral magical tools with this creative visualization of the magical alphabet. It links it to the power of your magical voice, which completes the sensory loop to your subconscious mind and quadruples the effect. This is a technique of considerable value and very easy to learn and to do. It will give you the ability to pronounce names of power in the full magical sense of the word. After mastering objects and astral formula creation, you should work on creating god forms, angelic icons, the Tibetans call these anthropomorphic symbolic figures, tonkas. In the OTA, we start with the four archangels of the quarters, Raphael, Michael, Gabriel, and Uriel. Yes, and the first two are male and the second pair are female in our system. And if you want to see our Gabura warrior goddess from Anat, she's pictured in our new tarot card Conquest, Accessing Da'ath, and you want to see the seventh ray, book two, the red ray for that, make these forms so real and plastic that they are ready to come alive, and then they will come alive. What you see is what you get. So now, how do we learn to do all this with eyes open? Well, it's much easier than you probably thought. First, you will be doing this in a subdued light on a prepared surface. One magical school used a blue velvet drape for this purpose. But some years ago, I discovered how to make the transition from eyes closed to eyes open. A very easy process. You start by simply opening your eyes behind your blindfold. It's hardly any different than with your eyes closed and you got your object on front screen. Now, once you've gotten this technique to working, then adjust the light as low as necessary and slowly remove the blindfold, extending your focus to the black velvet or black or velvet broadcloth drape, and you will quickly discover that there was no great hurdle to overcome. Now, clairaudience. It would be the depth of folly to work for months creating an angelic remnant of God form, which would finally appear in full glory and visual splendor, but would be utterly silent. In the case of our and Almadil invocations and Goetic invocations, the entities most often engender knowings in our minds or speak through our lips in the mediumistic channeling process. Now, having perfected these methods of spirit communication, you can fall back on them to provide a voice for your advanced freeform visualizations. But why not upgrade your interplane vocal communication process as well? Now, Barton recommends combining imagined sounds with your imagined pictures. See and hear bells ringing, clocks ticking, birds singing, and so on. And imagine the sound of OM and the names of archangels, the names of power, the tetragrammaton. Get a set of tuning forks, a pitch pipe, or an electronic synthesizer to attune your psychic centers, your chakras, to the musical scale, and hear these notes in audio memory, then create them. And don't forget smell, touch, and taste. Try eating your favorite meal on the astral, but be careful not to violate your diet. Astral ice cream will not make you fat, but it might erode your willpower and thus accomplish the same thing indirectly. What you see is what you get. Remember that modern psychology confirms what magicians have known for thousands of years. A vivid apparition can be as awe-inspiring or as terrifying to the human mind as any manifestation of what the materialists call reality. Beyond that significant fact lies the deeper and more profound truth of the creative powers inherent in such a process. Well, that concludes our lesson on that. Next week, we're going to have a discussion on magical hypnosis, and we're going to get into in depth on that subject. And hopefully, I'm going to have one of my esteemed colleagues, Ann Finnan, who has become quite a magical hypnotist. She's taken professional courses in hypnotism, and she's especially good at magical hypnosis. Well, I have her call in, and she and I will expound on hypnosis and magic, and that will be very, very well worth tuning into. Creative visualization is one of the most powerful techniques, and one of the most satisfying and technique that, by the way, just really can do nothing but improve your concentration. It improves your concentration, improves your focus, improves your entire life can be improved by it. But hypnosis, self-hypnosis and hypnosis are very important to that. So be sure and tune in next week and have some call-ins, and you can talk to myself, and you can talk to me. Well, Ann's on the phone, of course you can't, but you can call in after she's wrapped up, and we can talk about the whole hypnotic process. And this, by the way, was suppressed. The whole hypnotic process in magic was suppressed until just really literally. I broke the dam on this one because I published a paper in 1972 called Magic and Hypnosis in Gnostica magazine, and this has been reprinted in Europe, and it's translated into German. It's a landmark paper. So before that, people just didn't want to admit that hypnosis really, really is essential to magic. They didn't want to admit it. So now we know. Okay, so tune in next week, and we'll get deeply into it. Good magic.